Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. We love a good success story, but we love an epic fail even more.
She was launched sort of as an alternative to Barbie. Barbie is beautiful, successful, and happy. Little Miss No Name is the opposite. She's begging for empathy. She's got a tear in her eye. She's got raggy clothes on. Little girls were just terrified of her. She looks like something out of a horror film.
Let's visit the Museum of Failure, coming up. And we'll hear from the man who created the images for Aliens, Blade Runner and Tron, visual futurist Sid Mead. But we begin today's show by skipping straight to dessert, specifically cake. Today, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Masterpiece Cake Shop Limited versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. That's the case involving a Colorado baker named Jack Phillips, who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, David Mullins and Charlie Craig, citing religious objections. He also says that being forced to make a cake violates his right to free speech. The couple claims it's discrimination. Well, this story has many layers, but no matter how you slice it, this case has stirred up the culinary world. Clémence Gossett is a pastry chef, and she's co-owner of the Gourmandise School in Santa Monica.
Anybody who works in food is really sort of working from their soul and creating something out of nothing. It's absolutely an art form. And the idea of creating something and deciding who can consume it and who can appreciate your art is sort of doesn't really fall into the ethos of art, right? Like, it just doesn't fall in line with who we are as people who craft food.
That was Clémence Gossett. Let's turn now to Cody Christensen. He's manager of Cake and Art in West Hollywood, and he had a role in gay wedding cake making history.
Well, I was very honored to be the person who delivered the wedding cake to the first gay couple to legally get married in California. That was before Prop 8, when there was a little bit of a window where gay marriage was legal in California. So to deliver that cake was monumental for them, but it was also a big deal for me because I myself am gay. And so it opened my eyes to like what my future could possibly be too. You know, now I could get married. I haven't found the man of my dreams yet, but I could then get married, you know.
Okay, well, for men out there, Cody is at Cake and Art, and he makes fabulous cakes. Did this experience also open your future as a cake-making artist in terms of the possibilities for cake designs?
Well, the amazing thing about Cake and Art, really, is that we are so open-minded to anybody. Like, we've been doing gay wedding cakes even before it was legal, you know, for just when people wanted to express their love in front of the people that they love, and they had a ceremony, we would do that anyways, because we love, you know, and we're gay owned and operated, and we don't discriminate against anybody.
Is there any cake that you would not make if you were asked to do it? For example, say someone came and they wanted to put on their cake some message that was against gay marriage?
Well, this is one of my favorite questions. Cake and Art, we are artists, and we respect people's visions and their ideas and their imaginations for their cake. Now, I may not like what I'm putting on the cake. Let's say they said straight marriage only, but because we don't discriminate and we believe in free speech, and it's your cake. You know, you can put whatever you want to on it. You're the one that's going to have to show it to people.
A commentator writing about this Supreme Court case referred somewhat kind of jokingly to Mr. Phillips in Colorado as the Bernini of buttercream. We checked out his cakes and they look generally to be the traditional three-tiered cake with white frosting and flowers, somewhat traditional. Does that make him a Bernini of buttercream?
No, I don't think it makes him a Bernini, Bellini, whoever you want to call yourself. I think an artist, if you consider yourself a master artist or an artist in general, your mind should be open to all sorts of beauty and any type of design that someone comes at you with. I mean, your job is to make cakes, and it's to make beautiful cakes and to make the person on the other side of the counter happy.
Well, it turns out that Mr. Phillips in Colorado also rejects commissions for Halloween cakes. So, and I think West Hollywood also probably makes some pretty fabulous cakes that mark Halloween.
It sounds like this gentleman needs to have a Bellini and then open his mind a little bit to making cakes.
So tell us about some of, I mean, you have done cakes for many celebrities, for children. You've done certainly some erotic cakes. We won't get into the descriptions of those erotic cakes on air. But pull out, will you, some of your Sistine ceilings of cakes.
I mean, you know, one of our biggest clients over the years has been the Jackass company, you know, the MTV show. I mean, they have asked us to do some crazy designs, and we've always said yes. I did a couple of Christmases ago, Jessica Biel invited me to decorate cupcakes with the children at the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and that was such a beautiful moment. I also got to deliver a cake to the Playboy Mansion for an Oscar winner's birthday party, and I got to sit with Hugh Hefner and the girls, and I got to cut the cake for them.
What was the cake like?
It was like a 2-3 foot long cakes. I photoshopped the new kids on the block into like Pirates of the Caribbean outfits because this Oscar winner, Diablo Cody, she loved the new kids on the block. And she also loved Pirates of the Caribbean. So we made this whole thing, Pirates of the Caribbean, new kids theme, and they showed up to the party. So I ended up dancing with Joey and his wife. I mean, that's what cake is about. Cake is about making something beautiful and then making someone's event beautiful. And it should be about happiness and joy.
I particularly was very drawn to some of your cakes in the shape of, you know, a favorite pet or a cake you did for the Getty Center in the shape of the Getty Center.
Right. Yeah. That's just another level of our artistic ability, doing cakes for the Getty Center in the shape of the Getty Center. For the L.A. Philharmonic, for their big anniversary a couple of years ago, we did the L.A. Philharmonic building, the Disney Concert Hall. We take their inspiration and their architecture, and we can turn it into an edible piece of art, which I think is amazing.
We are in holiday season. Are you busy working on cakes for Hanukkah, cakes for Christmas?
Oh, my gosh. We just did 4 giant gingerbread houses that are, like, 2 feet tall, 3 feet, I don't even know. They're so big. It took like days. And so we look forward to people coming in and giving us these crazy orders because we love to make cake and we love to do it artistically.
And you love to let them eat cake.
Yes, let them eat cake. We donated some cakes to the LA Christmas parade last weekend, and we got invited to go up to the VIP area. And I had 2 slices of my own cake at the event. I had my cake and I ate it too.
You heard from Cody Christensen, manager of Cake and Art in West Hollywood. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And coming up after this break, remember Pepsi Crystal, Trump Steaks, or Harley Davidson perfume? They're all in a museum of failures. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. They say that success has many fathers, but failure is an orphan. Well, here are some of the orphans you just may remember.
And Sony Betamax records a sharper picture than VHS.
With its fabulous styling and smooth writing, Bic for Her is the only choice.
The DeLorean is one of the most awaited automobiles in automotive history.
Wait, Trump, the game, from Milton Bradley.
I think you'll like it.
Mr. Trump's proceeds from Trump the Game will be donated to charity.
That's Trump the Game. And before that, ads for the Betamax cassette recorder, Bic for Her pens, and the DeLorean car made famous in Back to the Future. You can find all of these represented at a new pop-up museum founded by Samuel West. The pop-up is called the Museum of Failure, and it's currently located at the A+D Museum in the Arts District in downtown LA. West shows us some of the items on display, an actual Ford Edsel, the famed Apple Newton PDA that failed because its handwriting recognition feature didn't work, the VFX1 virtual reality goggles that appeared in 1995 before VR technology was ready, a 1965 doll by Hasbro called Little Miss No Name, and a bizarre doll for adults that you'll hear about in a moment. Even though Silicon Valley entrepreneurs wear their failures with pride, companies typically prefer to bury them. So Wes decided to show them off.
We've got the Olestra calorie-free fat that didn't make you fat, but it caused explosive diarrhea.
Well, that's a lovely way to start.
Yeah, I find starting conversations and interviews with diarrhea sort of moves things along.
So, but it's not all to do with food or diet inventions?
No.
Mostly technological, I think.
Yeah, I mean, most of the innovations are tech.
But what made you decide this museum needed to exist?
I seriously got really, really fed up with all the narratives of success. And as a society, we worship success. And the more we worship success, the more failure gets stigmatized. And I truly believe that we have so much more to learn from failure than we do success. But we can't learn from failure if we're afraid of it. And I think this museum is one of many sort of initiatives to say, hey, let's reevaluate failure as, you know, it hurts and it's nothing we want, but it's something that we can actually learn from if we're willing to talk about it.
That's so interesting. So tell us how you did create this collection.
It started off quite easy, looking on Craigslist and whatnot to find the initial artifacts, but then it got more and more difficult. Luckily, when the museum opened in Sweden, it got a lot of global attention. And now I get a lot of donations. And here at the exhibit in LA, 40-50% of the artifacts are donations.
But
from individuals, not from companies.
Now, it also seems as if you've got sort of two types of failed products in the exhibit here. One is the instant failure. It goes into the stores and immediately people hate it. And then there's the product that actually did sell for a while, but it was superseded by a new technology. Is the second one, say, for example, you have Blockbuster, the store Blockbuster. I think you have Betamax. There's several products that just had a short shelf life, but they did well while they existed. Is that really failure?
The Blockbuster is an excellent example and a cautionary tale of what happens when you fail to innovate, when you fail to take the risks. Meaningful risks. So Blockbuster, 9,000 stores, they were huge. They briefly invested in internet streaming because they knew that was the future. But they made their profits, I think it was almost 37% of their profits came from late fees. Now, they were not willing to continue to invest in internet streaming because it risked their profits from late fees. Several years later, Netflix killed Blockbuster because of their new business model that didn't include late fees. So Blockbuster was not a case of failed innovation. It was a failure to innovate.
But then you have, I think, a third type of failed product, which is the product that seems to have been kind of too ahead of its time, like you have VFX1, even Google Glass.
Yes.
What, 2 years ago? Seemed to be a terrible failure, but we read that Google Glass is actually seeming to find its moment again.
Yeah, interesting. When Google, the project manager, tweeted that they were launching Google Glass Enterprise, I tweeted back, like, send me a copy to the museum. Like, sort of, ha ha ha. No reply.
You have some products here that were sent you. You even have a product that was sent you by the designer itself, who kind of admitted to his own failure, the new spoon. Talk about that.
And so I love that story. It's an inventor who launched, he was really environmentally sort of aware. He wanted to get rid of the plastic spoons that litter our environment. So he created what he called the new spoon, which is an origami foldable spoon. And he told me he spent so much time getting this right. And I think it's a great design. But the problem was he couldn't figure out how to communicate or how to sort of instruct consumers on how to fold this simple spoon. And that's why it flopped. And his email to me was that he had spent all his savings on this and bought like pallets of these spoons, prototypes, and now they're all in his mother's garage. And he wanted to donate it to the museum so that it wouldn't be a complete failure.
Is there an object that you have in the show that you wish hadn't failed?
I have a crowdfunded innovation called No More Woof, and I wish that one actually existed. So it was a EEG, sort of brainwave sensor, that would translate a dog's thoughts into human language. So you stick this sensor on your dog's head and it translates. The dog can say, "I'm hungry, take me for a walk." Whatever the dog is thinking, you would hear. Well, it turned out that it was a total bluff. It never existed, couldn't possibly exist, but it'd be really cool if it did, wouldn't it?
Do you think that attests to our human capacity for gullibility?
Absolutely, and I think our expectations and trust in that technology will solve all our problems makes us very open to believing even the most unbelievable sort of innovations or promises of innovation. And the No More Woof is a fun example of that. People invested their money to buy it when there's no possible way that it could ever exist.
Let's take a look at Little Miss No Name.
Oh man, look at her. She was launched sort of as an alternative to Barbie. Barbie is beautiful, successful, and happy. Little Miss No Name is the opposite. She's begging for empathy. She's got a tear in her eye. She's got raggy clothes on. But if you look at her, she looks scary. So, I mean, little girls were just terrified of her. She looks like something out of a horror film.
Well, and according to your description, you've said she can now be found all over the internet in short films from horror to comedy. So she did become, so in a way, she found a different kind of success.
You're very insistent on finding success in these failures. I'm not. I love that, some products, most products, they're failure, period.
Okay, what are we looking at here, Samuel, and tell us its story?
This is the silicon sex doll. It's a Chinese service. You can rent a sex doll. It's called Shared Girlfriend. So for $45, you can just order your girlfriend on an app. You could choose Miss Russia, Miss Asia, Miss Africa, I think, and Wonder Woman, in case that's your fancy. And then the sex doll will be delivered to your home. And then you would get instructions on how to use it from somebody, a staff member. I can just imagine an awkward moment there. And then you have your sex doll for a day. And when it's returned, of course, they promise to clean it up and replace worn body parts. So the shared economy, Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, this is just an extension of that, where you now can share your girlfriend, aka a silicone sex toy.
But it's in your museum of failure.
Yes, this service from this company in China, it only lasted 4 days before they were shut down by the government.
Did you write to the company to ask for the sex doll?
Yeah, one of my interns, she's from China, and she wrote them and said, "Hey, your failed service would fit perfectly in the Museum of Failure." So they sent it over. Come and touch her.
Let's
I want to hear your reaction.
Oh, no. That is weird. Avishai, you've got to touch.
Yeah, you've got to touch.
You don't have to touch her there.
I touched her knee.
You touched her knee, yes.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of give to it. I thought it would be hard. Yeah. Like rubber.
Can you stop touching her like that?
You have to pay, Avishai. That's Samuel West. He's founder of the Museum of Failure. It's at the Architecture and Design Museum, or A+D, for the next 2 months. You can see images from the collection at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now let's go from failures of the past to visions of the future, some of which are morphing into reality.
It seems you feel our work is not a benefit to the public.
Replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. They're a benefit, it's not my problem.
That's a clip from the 1982 movie Blade Runner. Its stunning visuals bear the fingerprints of Sid Mead. He's the longtime illustrator, product and car designer who calls himself a visual futurist. He also created imagery for the movies Star Trek, Aliens and Tron. Tonight, at the Southern California Institute of Architecture, or SIARC, he will talk with his longtime friend, the architect Craig Hodgetts. Together, they've published a new book, The Movie Art of Sid Mead, Visual Futurist. We spoke with both of them and started by asking Craig what he finds so interesting about Mead's work.
Sid is absolutely unique, in my view, in his ability to look into the crystal ball and not create a fantasy image, but create a future image and a future reality, which is very firmly based on our physical laws and on the environment that we exist in now. So any one of Sid's illustrations opens a door into a plausible reality.
Would you say that Blade Runner is an expression of that?
Just today, I was looking at one of the image you have of the robotic dog with all of its metallic musculature. And it's amazingly like the products that are now being produced robotically for the consumer. Yes. And again, there's that 40-year gap.
I was originally hired only to do the vehicles, and I approached them as characters in each case because that's essentially what they were. And then I painted them in situ, following the cues from the script, this dystopian urban world, and Ridley liked that. He's an artist himself. And so, yeah, I painted myself into the rest of the film.
Have you both seen the remake, and what do you think of it?
Yes, I have. I think it stands alone. The fear of the diehard fans was that it would bleed off the original unashamedly, but it did not. It stands by itself. There are very subtle homage cues to the original movie, but not many. It's beautifully photographed. It's almost illyrical, the coloration and the pace of the film.
Well, my friends who've seen it, I also saw it, found the sort of robotic girlfriend to be the most amazing invention of the film, as she changes clothes and morphs into from reality to a hologram.
I loved her. I did. Craig, we're going to see these avatars like that coming soon. In the future, and maybe not too far away, if you show up in person, that would be the ultimate honor to the, because otherwise you'd send your avatar, whether holographically or a robotic duplicate of yourself, you know.
I think one of the things that totally unites the pair of you in terms of shared interests is vehicles and now mobility. And right now we're in a very fascinating mobility moment.
Yes, we are. Well, my sort of operational idea or notion is that if it's a good idea, it'll eventually happen. And the self-driving automobile, they're all racing to be the first to actually have it on the streets for the average person. It's a remarkable technology. The LIDAR, which is the little rotating thing on top of the cars, creates a three-dimensional view of objects in motion in real time for the computer to make the decisions. And the biggest kind of block to acceptance is going to be simply, does the public trust the machine? That's all. And I think, you know, you'll have a steering wheel for quite some time because people feel secure if they can grab onto that. And that's eventually, though, the cars will be literally semi-intelligent entities that take you where you want to go, talk back to you, hold a conversation, tell you that, no, it's not going to snow tomorrow, so we'll pick you up at 8 as usual. It's going to be a conversational voice interaction with the car's neural computer system.
I think the fascination or the ghost in that particular image is that the cityscape will change radically. You know, curbs and street signs and all of these things in future cities will be redundant. They won't be required. And there will be a very, very different relationship between vehicles and pedestrians, shopping. The autonomous vehicles very likely will not park somewhere. They will simply go on and pick up another passenger.
And we'll come to a time when if you don't have a transponder on your self-driven vehicle, you won't be allowed on the streets because you're a danger to the whole system.
There's a feeling that life's happening very fast right now and technological change is happening very fast. One, do you think it is? And two, are there any innovations that we're living with now that really caught you by surprise?
Well, the newest thing to catch my surprise is graphene. It's a latticework of one atom thick carbon atoms in a latticework, hexagonal latticework. this is the remarkable thing about nature forces. It is so strong. Now, this sounds impossible, but if you could balance a school bus on the end of a pencil with the point poking into the graphene membrane, and it's almost invisible because it's one atom thick, you would barely be able to puncture that film, which is astonishing. It's 300 times stronger than steel, and they're trying now to ramp up the production of graphene sheet so they can make things out of it, fold it, make beams and things. It's going to change everything just like the microchip did. That's what they're saying at the forefront of that technology.
At SIARC tonight, people will be able to see a lot of Sid's illustrations. Craig, if you can paint a verbal picture of Sid's visuals, do that for us, because that's going to be, you know, an exciting to see tonight.
Well, what's exciting about the visuals of Sid's artistic vision is that he realizes these just hypnotic and extremely visceral images with the simplest of tools, a colored pencil, you know, a piece of paper. And what emerges out of these various media that he uses are things which present a photographic reality of an alternative future. And the resolution is almost uncanny. The only thing that I can relate it to are the classical paintings of people like Vermeer, who studied existing subject matter in order to make their paintings. In Sid's case, there is nothing there. Only his imagination is there, staring back at him as he uses his pencil to realize this vision that's inside of his head.
And I was very fortunate when I went through school.
School being art center.
Yes, to be exposed to Caravaggio, to even to Chirico, those blank streets, strange art, Dufay, and masters for shading and light. And because essentially what you have to work with is light and shade, isn't it, and color. But the light and shade is most important because that models the scene. And then you can colorize it or paint it in color to begin with. But you have to have a knowledge of that interaction of light falling on objects and so forth. And what you can do artificially is to just invent a shadow. You don't care where it's coming from, but if it's compositionally helpful, then you do that. That's the glory of not being a photographer. I can put that shadow any place I want.
You've been listening to visual futurist Sid Mead and architect Craig Hodgetts. They'll talk tonight at SIARC. Find information about that on our 5 Design Things to Do This Week post at kcrw.com/DNA blog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening.